This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Japan's government has decided to start releasing massive amounts of treated radioactive water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean in 2 years, an option fiercely opposed by local fishermen and residents. The decision, long speculated but delayed for years due to safety concerns and protests, came at a meeting of cabinet ministers who endorsed the ocean release as the best option. The accumulating water has been stored in tanks at the Fukushima plant since 2011, when a massive earthquake and tsunami damaged its reactors and their cooling water became contaminated and began leaking. The attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility is casting a major shadow over Tuesday's resumption of indirect talks between the United States and Iran over resurrection of the international accord limiting Iran's nuclear program. Neither Iran nor the U.S. say the incident will crater the negotiations, but the attack and the destruction of a significant amount of Iran's uranium enrichment capability add uncertainty to the discussions in Vienna. The attack gives both sides reason to harden their positions, yet each has incentives to keep the talks on track. Iran wants Washington to lift sanctions that have contributed to damaging its economy, including measures not related to its nuclear program. It insists that the sanctions be lifted before it returns to compliance the 2015 nuclear agreement that then-President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of in 2018. This is VOA News. The White House said on Monday that it is concerned about Russia's increasing aggression on the Ukraine border and that this will be a subject of talks between senior U.S. and NATO officials this week. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the United States has been watching it over the course of the weekend, the increasing aggression of Russian forces on the border. She said U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin are in Brussels this week, and she's sure this will be a topic of discussion. She said U.S. officials are in contact with Ukrainian officials as well. In the wake of another deadly shooting of a black man, this time in Minneapolis suburbs, a retired police officer who now trains other police says officers across the country need more training, especially in the use of force and how to prevent incidents from getting out of hand. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
During a traffic stop Sunday in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, 20-year-old motorist Dante Wright began scuffling with officers, leading one to pull what she thought was her taser. That from her body cam. Retired California police officer Rick Serrato, who now trains other police, says forget the fact that a taser doesn't look, feel, or weigh like a handgun. The incident should have never reached that point.
There's not enough training placed on escalation of force and how to deal with situations and how to handle situations rather than to jump to deadly force.
Experts agree mistaking a handgun for a taser is a real but very rare occurrence, probably less than once a year across the country. I'm Tim McGuire.
Prosecutor's case against the former officer Derek Chauvin drew toward a close Monday with tender memories from George Floyd's younger brother, along with another look at the harrowing video and testimony from a use of force expert who said no reasonable officer would have done what Chauvin did. Seth Stoughton, a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, judged Chauvin's actions against what a reasonable police officer in the same situation would have done and repeatedly found that Chauvin did not meet that test. Authorities say a student at a Tennessee high school fired at officers and was killed by police. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation Director David Rouse said at a news conference Monday that police responded to a report of a possible gunman at Austin East Magnet High School in Knoxville, Tennessee. He says the officers found him in the bathroom to order him to come out. He would not comply. He says that's when the student reportedly opened fire. Police fired back, killing that student. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Somalia's lower house extends President Farmajo's term, but some say the move is unconstitutional.
In order to extend the term of the parliament as well as the term of the presidency, there has to be a constitutional amendment to be made of those two articles in the constitution. That has not taken place.
We will have analysis of a likely international community reaction. A three-day capacity building workshop to empower women is taking place in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Experts discuss how best to fight the COVID-19 pandemic in Africa, and DRC President Tshisekedi announces a new cabinet.
They are a majority of young people, but they are also some old people. There are a lot of ladies. They are, I think, 17 to 18 ladies. More than the previous cabinet.
And the government of Mali is sued in the ECOWAS court over FGM. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somalia's election standoff took an odd turn on Monday after a Mogadishu police commander ordered lawmakers to suspend planned talks on a way forward due to security concerns and was promptly fired. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia's lower house of parliament voted overwhelmingly to extend by 2 years the term for the government of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo. The special session saw 149 MPs vote in favor of the extension, with only 3 opposed. Within minutes, the upper house of parliament objected, with the speaker saying the move by the lower house is unconstitutional. However, an article in Somalia's provisional constitution gives the lower house the decision-making power over electoral matters. Either way, there is no sign that Somalia's delayed parliamentary and presidential elections will begin anytime soon. The polls, originally scheduled to start late last year, never got off the ground because of disputes between political leaders on who will control the electoral process. The talks to end the impasse ended in deadlock despite pressure from the African Union, European Union, and other international partners of the Somali government. The Speaker of the Parliament, Mohamed Mursal, said Monday that lawmakers must take responsibility as representatives of the people to take decisions when the need arises. He says the current state facing the people in the country will not allow continued political impasse that resulted in the election delay. He said they represent the interest of the nation and the citizens are waiting their decision. Hence, the move to extend 2 years' term to plan for ballot elections. President Farmajo, whose term in office technically expired on 8 February, immediately welcomed the extension approved by the lower house. In a statement, the president urged the citizens to seize the historic chance to choose their democratic destiny. However, the members of opposition led by former Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre warned that the extending president's term could have negative consequences. He says that it is the right time for the Somalis to acknowledge that the decision by outgoing president regarding his illegal stay in office is leading to a dangerous path. The former PM added that history will judge the decision taken by the leaders if they are not careful. Earlier, the country's police chief, Abdi Mohamed Hassan, fired Mogadishu regional police commander, General Sadiq Omar, after he tried to suspend the parliamentary session, citing security concerns. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
A Somali member of parliament and former security minister says the international community has invested billions of dollars in Somali stability since 2006 and would not want the country to return to its pre-2006 status. Abdi Razak Omar Mohammed says the African Union and the United Nations will do everything in their power to ensure a smooth transition of power in Somalia, including an election. This comes after Somalia's House of Representatives on Monday voted to extend President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo's term. President Farmajo, whose term ended February 2021, is refusing to step down or facilitate the holding of free and fair elections. Omar Mohamed says the lower house decision is unconstitutional.
The constitution limits the term of the parliament to 4 years, and it limits the term of the presidency to 4 years as well. So in order to extend the term of the parliament as well as the term of the presidency, there has to be a constitutional amendment to be made of those two articles in the constitution. That has not taken place. The second illegality is that the parliament consists of two houses, the upper house and the lower house. If there's an extension that is to be discussed, both houses of the parliament has to be present and they have to vote. There's an extension that was made by the lower house of the parliament. Its legality is questionable, and I don't think it's going to hold on.
As you said, it's illegal, but why do you think the parliament voted that way, that they split? Why that?
We have been warning that the current president has autocratic tendencies. He has refused to negotiate on the election procedure with the federal member states. He has always looked to extend his term, and the only way that he can do that was to use the parliament.
If I'm not mistaken, this decision in parliament contradicts what the African Union and the United Nations and even SADC, they believe that over the weekend they issue a statement that they will not support any extension of the president's term. What does that mean now?
Yeah, well, the statement that they have issued was there shouldn't be any extension, but to go on to reach a consensus on the electoral model based on the framework of September 17. That did not happen. It's very clear that the current president has ignored all those warnings. He has unilaterally decided to go ahead with the extension by using the parliament. Unfortunately, the legislature has become part of the executive branch.
To help me to understand, or our listeners to understand, where do you think all this is headed?
Well, on the one hand, there are the international community that has been saying statement after statement that there shouldn't be any extension of the parliament and there shouldn't be any extension of the term of the president. So what I think would happen is that the international community, I think they will take an extreme position this time around, because they have invested $50 billion since 2006 up to now. And they don't want to see Somalia slide back to 1991 when the civil war started in Somalia. So they will do everything at their power, everything in their position to make sure that there's a smooth transition of power, there's an election that takes place. They will not support the extension that the parliament made today.
It's always very nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
Thank you. Abdi Razak Omar Mohamed is a Somali member of parliament and a former security minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mogadishu. A member of parliament in the Democratic Republic of Congo says President Felix Tshisekedi's new cabinet, announced on Monday, is representative of the Congolese society. Lambert Mende, who served as information minister in former President Joseph Kabila's government, says the new cabinet is also youthful and comprises several women. Since winning the 2018 presidential election, Tshisekedi and Kabila were in a coalition in parliament, with Kabila's party holding majority of seats and thereby wielding influence. But in January this year, pro-Kabila Prime Minister Sylvester Ilunga resigned following a vote of no confidence in parliament. Tshisekedi formed a new majority coalition and named a prime minister. Mende says the new cabinet comprises representatives of Jean-Pierre Bemba and Moïse Katumbi.
Let me say that it is the enlargement of the majority. So there is a lot of parties. There are 56 ministers and deputy ministers. The former government, they were 66. So he reduced of 10 ministries. The new foreign minister is a member of the party of Mr. Katumbi.
So Mr. Katumbi is in the coalition?
He is within the coalition as well as Pemba, as well as others, the UDPS, even my party, we are there. I'm represented by a lady, Mrs. Karume, who is in charge of relations with the parliament. So it is a very large framework.
Talking about very large framework, is this new cabinet bigger than the previous cabinet of either Kabila or...
No. It is not larger than the one of Professor Ilunga, because the cabinet of Professor Ilunga, the first one of Tshisekedi with Kabila, was comprised of 66 ministers, and these ones have only 56, so they are 10 ministers less.
What about Mr. Bemba? Is he part of the government?
Mr. Bemba is a part of the government because Mrs. Bazaiba, who is the deputy of Mr. Bemba, is also in that government, I think, in charge of infrastructure.
I understand most of the members of this new cabinet are young. What does that mean?
Yes, they are a majority of young people, but they are also some old people, like Mr. Mutinga, who is there since Mobutu times. There are a lot of ladies. They are, I think, 17 to 18 ladies, more than the previous cabinet.
I was asking Mr. Bemba, Mr. Katumbi, so members of their party are in the government, but Mr. Bemba and Mr. Katumbi themselves are not in the government.
No, they are not in the government, but they have designated people to represent them, as I did myself. I sent someone. You are not forced to be there yourself. Since you have confidence on some people, you can designate them and leave them work.
What does this mean now, this new parliament? What does that mean now for President Tshisekedi?
Well, the government will come to appear before the parliament. We are waiting for them maybe next week or the end of this week, so that we give them what we call investiture, so that they start working. They are now preparing the program of their government. They will come to defend it, but... no doubt that they will be allocated that investment.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Lambert Mende is a former Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister in former President Joseph Kabila's government. He is now a member of parliament. You are speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 13. In Ghana, a three-day capacity building workshop to empower women ends in the capital, Accra, tomorrow, Wednesday. Organized by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, and the UN Development Program, UNDP, the workshop seeks to guide women about market entry under the African Continental Free Trade Area. For more about the significance of the three-day workshop and the anticipated impact, viewers Peter Clotty reached Frederick Mugisha, the UNDP Economic Advisor for Ghana and the Gambia.
This workshop is actually helping bring the AFTA to small and medium enterprises, focusing on women and youth-led enterprises. And the idea is to help them understand what AFTA is and the opportunities there are.
So what does this workshop seeks to mainly achieve?
It is seeking to achieve a couple of things. Number one, it is seeking to close the knowledge gap. In Ghana, Statistical Service did a survey recently, and only a quarter of the micro businesses who employ 1 to 6 people actually knew what AFTA is. That's one. The second, it is aimed to help begin to put together what kind of support will be required. And using the same survey, the small one said, please, the three top ones was, please reduce the cost of credit, remove regulatory barriers, and identify opportunities for us. And so, and the big businesses also too, the same, in a different order. So we are beginning to say, okay, what is it that can be done in concrete terms? And then finally, it will help shed light on dimensions of inclusion, that is women, youth, geography, and the cross-border value chains that may be neglected.
What will be the anticipated major takeaways from the workshop for these women?
For these women, they will know deeper on what AFTA is, and the takeaway will be, yes, we can engage, We have a few more questions, but we know where to get those questions answered.
Will there be a mechanism or some form of measurement to actually determine their progress after this workshop?
Yes. So part of the partnership that we have also with the secretariat is that we are going to track a number of businesses on the progress they are making with the Continental Free Trade Area. And that will enable us to know what the opportunities are, what they are dealing with, and the progress they are making. The ultimate is that, indeed, the AFTA, as you probably know, the AFTA area is meant to help kind of create and shape the next relationship with the Africa's relationship with the rest of the world. And that means the transformation of the continent that is brought about by AFTA will not only benefit the Africans, but also the world over, to allow them to engage.
That was Frederick Mugisha, the UNDP Economic Advisor for Ghana and the Gambia. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotte. Women's rights organizations have filed a case in the Economic Community of West African States ECOWAS Court of Justice challenging Mali's lack of law prohibiting female genital mutilation. Grace Uwezeh of Equality Now tells Ricky Stryak that while communities in Mali have made public declarations against FGM, the groups want the Malian government to pass laws prohibiting FGM.
Our main objective of filing this case to the ECOWAS Court is basically to influence the government of Mali to adopt a law against FGM, which we hope that once this law is in place, then it can protect girls who are at risk of undergoing FGM, but at the same time also prosecute the perpetrators of this practice. So we hope that this case alone prompts the government to actually start now looking into ways of adopting an anti-FGM law.
What are some of the obstacles to adopting an anti-FGM law, both from the micro, I guess, on the town, family, community level, up to the macro when you've got parliament and maybe upper level political leaders? What are some of those challenges?
So basically, we have been working in Mali for the past, I think, 20 years now, and we have had a couple of conversations with the government and the community, the religious leaders. So the main challenge actually comes from the religious leaders who have so much influence, a great influence over what's happening around when it comes to enactment of an anti-FGM law. Back in 2017, there was an attempt of actually having a law in parliament, basically presenting a bill in parliament on prohibiting FGM. And there was a resistance coming from the religious leaders. So that bill was withdrawn. So that's our main challenge right now, is how to engage the religious leaders to come on board and support this campaign on having a law against FGM in Mali.
Even if the ECOWAS Court of Justice was to rule in favor of the efforts, are there still challenges in implementing the law if the religious leaders aren't on board with the idea behind the law, with the sentiment of the law?
So our hope is that the government of Mali will follow the judgment from the ECOWAS Court and go ahead and implement the law as it has, it has ratified many international and regional human rights instruments that protect, that protect girls and women from FGM. So we are hoping that they will, basically adhere to the agreement or to this ratification that they have done so in the past, and also continue having dialogues with the religious leaders at national level to show them really the importance of protecting girls from this practice.
Can you tell me about some of the women's rights organizations in Mali who are leading this charge?
Yes, there are a couple of women's rights Association Malienne pour la Suisse, and also there is Association pour le Progrès et la Défense des Droits des Femmes, APDF. These are the two organizations that we have really been working with on this campaign, and they are on the ground really having dialogues with the communities, with the religious leaders, also with the local, with the local officials, really showing them the need to protect the girls from this practice.
That was Grace Uwezeh of Equality Now. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi. Experts say the next step in fighting the COVID-19 pandemic in Africa and the next one is scaling up vaccine manufacturing on the continent. As VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, the experts met Monday to discuss how to do that.
South Africa recently started to produce COVID-19 vaccines and currently is the only African country to do so. While Africa has reported a relatively low number of cases compared to other regions, it has seen the world's slowest rollout of vaccination campaigns. To help remedy that, experts and heads of state are gathering virtually this week to mount a complex, ambitious plan to bring more of the manufacture of vaccines to the continent. One quarter of the world's COVID-19 vaccine doses have gone into the arms of Americans. The developing world has been far less fortunate, says Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the World Health Organization. He points out that residents of low-income countries have received less than 1% of all vaccines administered worldwide.
The pandemic has shown that global manufacturing capacity and supply chains are not sufficient to deliver vaccines and other essential health products quickly and equitably to where they are needed most. That's why building up vaccine manufacturing capacity in Africa is so important.
Economist Vera Songwe, Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, estimates that the pandemic has caused 100 million Africans to fall into poverty and the loss of 30 million jobs. If the continent can seize on medical manufacturing, she estimates that 6 million jobs can be created. And why stop at vaccines, she says.
There has been a long conversation about vaccine production. We have about 80 different variables that get into the vaccine production. So yes, Africa should produce vaccines, but the whole vaccine supply chain, syringes, plastics, containers for the vaccines also can and should be produced on the continent. This is the very essence of the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, that we build global supply chains and regional supply chains that allow us to do this.
Although experts are still hashing out the process for this, there's one thing they seem to agree on. It won't be quick or cheap. To fund the project, Songwe said, Africa is asking for much greater access to the International Monetary Fund's reserves. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala last month became the first African and the first woman to head the World Trade Organization. She said she's determined to prepare for the next disaster, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it makes fiscal sense.
We were not prepared for this pandemic globally. Spending billions of dollars before preparedness would have saved us trillions of dollars in response. The world is now learning how to do this better. For the next time, I'm putting in place a framework to manage the next pandemic. Africa must also prepare and think of how to do better for future crises.
Okonjo-Iweala noted this plan requires much more than time, care, and money. She says it will require changes to intellectual property laws, trade agreements, transport networks, research capabilities, and more. It's a big challenge, she said, but Africa can do it. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
After struggling through the coronavirus pandemic, tobacco farmers in Zimbabwe, Africa's largest tobacco producer, are pinning their economic hopes on tobacco selling season, which opened this month. Despite anti-smoking campaigns ahead of the World Health Organization's No Tobacco Day, which is May 31st, farmers say the crop is one of the most reliable for earning more stable foreign currencies. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
After quitting journalism at a government-controlled company 4 years ago, 39-year-old Itai Mazire went into farming. This year, he expects to sell at least 9,000 kilograms of tobacco from his 8-hectare plot about 150 kilometers east of Harare. Mazire says delayed selling seasons due to the coronavirus pandemic forced him to dip into his savings to pay workers. But Mazire says his harvest this year was the biggest ever, and he expects sales to more than double from that of 2020. After gold, tobacco is Zimbabwe's biggest foreign currency earner. The cash-strapped government expects earnings this year to jump from last year's $452 million to $800 million. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Murewa, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Tuesday, April 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Button, Washington, saying have a good day.